Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me right here next to me is Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. Matt, hi.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
We survived the postseason.
Survived. It was awesome.
It was awesome.
Loved every minute of it.
I got to go to all seven games, and it was fantastic. And game seven probably was the best, postseason game, probably just the best game I've ever seen in person. It was absolutely unbelievable. I called my 95-year-old great-uncle, who's a Cubs fan, who stayed up till the end with a bottle of champagne, and I said, you must have loved watching it. And he said, well, you were there. I would have given my right arm to have been there, which I thought was really cool. So, yes, postseason was awesome. The World Series was fantastic.
World Series postmortem question for you. A Cubs fan friend of mine said to me, if the Cubs lose that World Series, Joe Maddon is the new Grady Little. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
I disagree with that statement. I mean, I certainly did not support every move he made. For me, it was less about pulling Hendricks when he did, and more about having used Chapman the night before in Game 6 with a 5-run lead, I think. Because you could tell Chapman wasn't exactly capital letters Chapman. In Game 7, he gave up the Rajay Davis home run. His spin rate was down. His velocity was down. That was the issue for me.
Well, it wasn't just using him. It was, okay, using him to get out of the 7th. Okay, fine. Let him pitch the 8th. He's already warm. I don't like it, but bad. And then, even after they tacked on 2 runs, letting him start the 9th. Insanity.
I didn't love everything Maddon did, but it did feel like this weird undercurrent of actually Joe Maddon isn't a good manager and the Cubs won in spite of him, which I certainly don't agree with. Maybe it's just because Terry Francona looked so amazing by comparison. So I thought that was kind of weird, but I agree with you. I don't agree with you in the sense of being Grady Little, but I do agree with you there's some moves that I wasn't totally on board with.
For sure. But now, World Series, that's so 4 days ago.
It's so 4 days ago. Can you believe that today is already qualifying offer due date day? So in about 3 hours or so from when we're taping, this is the deadline for qualifying offer decisions. We've already seen a couple of them come out. It sounds like the Phillies are going to give one to Jeremy Hellickson. I can't believe we're already doing this. Like, the World Series just ended, it feels like.
Baseball never stops.
Baseball never stops. So let's talk a little bit about the free agency market. I think it's already pretty clear it's going to be a very interesting offseason, right? Because if you look at relief pitchers, just what happened in October probably inflated every decent reliever's market value. But you also have some really, really good closers out there. Jansen and Chapman and Mark Melancon and a couple other guys. They're going to get paid, like capital letters paid. Would you not agree?
Yeah, for sure. And to me, Jansen's the best one. But he's the only one that's going to have a qualifying offer attached to him because Melancon and Chapman both were traded during the season, which sort of negates the ability based on the current CBA rules. They can't get given. They're unable to be given a qualifying offer. So as we've seen in years past, that can sometimes make a huge difference. Now, usually with elite players, and these guys are all as closers, they are elite. It usually doesn't have as big of an impact. But when you three guys who are sort of similar, I think it could definitely. It should be interesting to see how that affects Jansen's market value, relatively speaking.
But I think we've talked about this otherwise. We both think he might end up with the Cubs. Is that where we're kind of predicting here?
I think the Cubs, the Cubs' sort of big weakness, as we saw in the World Series, is their bullpen. So the fact that they're going to end up with one of these three guys. And I kind of feel like they had the Chapman experience. Maybe they go back there. But to me, Jansen seems like a more obvious fifth. And obviously, lower stakes, they're going to be picking last in the first round.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That losing that first round pick does not really hurt them as much as it does most other teams. Now, if you have a top 10 pick, it's protected, so you'd lose your second round pick. But also, if you're a team that finished that poorly, you probably don't need to be spending big dollars on an ace closer. So maybe that is a good fit for them. I like that. All right, now who else the Cubs are going to lose? Cubs are probably going to lose Dexter Fowler, right? Where do we stand on Dexter Fowler? Because he seems like, I think he just finished his age 30 season and had his best year. Is that the new Dexter Fowler?
I think that for the short term, maybe he's a good player. But the fact of the matter with the Cubs is they're going to have Schwarber back. Presumably he's their everyday left fielder. They want Baez in the lineup every day at second base. That means Zobrist has to play right field. That probably means Jason Hayward, who's signed for another 6 or 7 years or whatever, is going to play center field. So, yeah, you could argue they want to keep the depth and maybe they want to keep Fowler, but I'm guessing it's not going to happen again this year.
I have two thoughts on this. One is that Dexter Fowler had his best defensive season ever. He went from negative 20 defensive runs saved 2 years ago to negative 12 last year to either even or plus one this year. He didn't become a better center fielder, right? You don't suddenly become a better defender at age 30. But as we've talked about a lot, they changed his positioning. They pushed him back by a bunch of feet. And you don't lose the extra base hits over your head when you're playing that much deeper. So I do wonder if teams will look at that, look at the Statcast positioning, or look at the defensive run saved to try to judge what he actually is in the outfield, right? I think that's interesting. And the second thought I have is, I feel like I'm in the minority here. I would so trade Kyle Schwarber this winter. The legend of Kyle Schwarber will never be more inflated than it is now. Trade him in a deal for Chris Archer. Go to the Angels and say, now is the time you're going to trade Mike Trout. We're going to start with him and a bunch of other guys. It's not going to happen, but it should totally happen, right?
I agree. I was, you know, I've thought this last offseason, even before he got hurt. So I feel the same way now. I think that he's the kind of player that hurts his value just by having to play the outfield. He should be a first baseman or a DH. I mean, a left-hand hitter like that playing for the Yankees, who now suddenly have a lot of young talent and just lost Teixeira off the books and A-Rod gone, like suddenly have a place for a, you know, bat-only, you know, DH first base type or even right field in that ballpark where it's a tiny amount of ground to cover.
But they don't have – who do they have to give up? Like the Cubs would probably want pitching more than hitting, I would think, in return, right?
Probably. So, you know, but it's not unfathomable for they could if the Cubs were so inclined, they could trade him any number of places. I don't think they're going to do it.
I don't think they're going to do it either. I suggested in a tweet the other day that they ought to consider it. And I heard from a million Cubs fans who said, well, it's not going to happen because Theo Epstein said they won't trade him. As if every, you know, executive, what they say in public should be taken at total face value.
Well, I want to go back to Fowler for a second because today on MLB.com, in a story written by Andrew Simon, we unveiled Tom Tango's or a projection by Tom Tango ranking the top 25 free agents based on WAR. It's basically a WAR-based version of the Marcel projection system. The last 3 years of WAR, the more recent years weighted more heavily with a penalty for age is the quick and dirty explanation.
Yeah, it takes your last 3 years, you weight the more recent years more heavily. As you said, there's a small regression and a little bit of age. It's named Marcel after Marcel the monkey from Friends, I think.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird. And it's supposed to be incredibly simple. And the idea is that it's the simplest projection system out there. And then you take all the other ones that add a million different layers and they're only slightly actually more impressive than that, which I think is kind of cool. Sometimes simpler is better.
So anyway, Fowler, going back to him for a second, he's fourth on the list, which I think, you know, if you're Dexter Fowler, you're feeling pretty good if you're, you know, coming into this offseason. Hey, I'm the fourth ranked free agent. Of course, this is based on WAR, so closers are going to take a hit just because it's not closers don't never pitch enough innings to build up their WARs. That's sort of built into this the projection. You kind of have to be aware of that and sort of know the context. So above, I think what will probably surprise some people is the number one name on this list.
It's not Yoenis Cespedes. That's correct. What everybody thinks it's going to be. He's number two. Number one is Justin Turner, which is actually, I think, pretty interesting. Now, he's a very good third baseman. He's coming off of three straight years of above-average production. He's basically hit almost as well as Chris Bryant over the last couple years, which you wouldn't think about a guy who got non-tendered by the Mets a couple winters
ago. And he also had a really bad start to this year.
Coming off a knee surgery.
Yes, and then I guess probably in maybe his mid-May or June, he took off and for the last 3 or 4 months was the Justin Turner of 2004. I mean, 2 years ago, he had a 158 weighted runs created plus. That's like...
That's really good.
That's like super, superstar level.
Over the last 3 years combined, it's a 138, so 38 percentage points above average, and that's really impressive. Now, he is 32. And I get the feeling he probably wants to stay in LA. He's from the area, but he's going to be in line for a pretty nice contract. Let's take a wild guess here. I'm going to say he gets 4 years and $85 million.
Yeah, that seems probably in the ballpark. He's just one of these players who doesn't have the pedigree, so I think people don't really know how to... There's going to be enough sort of skepticism around him that I feel like that'll hurt his... You know, even if he is actually the number one free agent on the market, there's enough skepticism around him that will probably hurt his overall value. My guess is the Dodgers have a need. They clearly have financial might. It seems he's a SoCal guy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, from Hollywood.
It seems like a natural fit.
I agree. So the next guy on the list that is interesting to me is number six, and that's Ian Desmond, right? You remember Ian Desmond last year coming off a pretty lousy season for Washington, got the qualifying offer, and sat out on the market until like the end of February, signed a one-year deal with Texas, moved from shortstop to center field, and actually did really well. The first half, he was fantastic, made the All-Star game, and my guess, and we don't think we know this yet, my guess is he's probably getting the qualifying offer again, right? And if you look at him, he actually really did not have a very good second half. In the second half, 283 on base, 65 weighted runs created plus, where 100 is league average. Over the previous two seasons, he was slightly below league average. This is a guy over the last 3 years who's basically had about 6 or 8 weeks of really good baseball. Should he take the qualifying offer?
It's too hard to know.
It bit him last year.
You know, it's and also the thing is, oh, can he go back out and sort of market himself as a shortstop again? Because there's not really, I mean, who's the best shortstop on the market right now?
Wow. That's a fantastic question. Who's the? I don't have an answer to that off the top of my head.
So he sort of has that going for him. And because, I mean, it's because this the perception of this year's market is that it's so weak, maybe you'll see more players rejecting the qualifying offer than we saw last year, thinking that, hey, in a weak market, maybe there'll be more demand. It's hard to know. I mean, I've never been a huge Ian Desmond fan as a player. He's got loud tools, but there's just, you know, too much swing and miss in his game for my liking.
Can you just imagine a second straight year of him being out there until February? We've seen that bike guys in the past. So I don't know. The other guy who stands out to me, Wilson Ramos. What do you do with Wilson Ramos? He was the best hitting catcher in baseball up until about a week before the end of the season when he blew out his right knee, which I think is the second time he's done that. Hard to see him being a full-time catcher going forward. He's probably not even going to be ready for opening day next year. How do you value that? It's a weak catching
market. I would have thought that a reunion with the Nats seemed likely to me before the knee injury, but I don't think the Nats are going to want to rely. They're a contending team. They're not going to want to roll the dice on a guy that, you know, may not be ready, may not be able to catch. They already sort of have to float Ryan Zimmerman at first base. They don't have a DH spot. So it's like, I could actually see Wieters, particularly now that he is, you know, not getting the qualifying offer. I could see him staying in the...
Maybe. I could see McCann getting traded there, too.
Yeah, that I could see that as well.
I know you wanted to talk about Luis Valbuena. Corner infielder from the Astros, which I think nobody really seems to know about him. He's an above-average hitter.
Yeah, he's sort of had a... Traded for Dexter Fowler 2 years ago. I feel like that's not part of the narrative surrounding him at all. I think most people forget that Dexter Fowler played on the Astros for that 1 year.
I sure do.
but Valbuena has got some pop from the left side, can play both corner positions. He'll be interesting to me as a qualifying offer guy because, like, he certainly doesn't seem like the caliber of player, but, like, on a one-year deal...
I don't think he'll get it.
Just because the Astros have so many options at that.
Gurriel and Bregman, both who can play third base.
If he's on the market without a qualifying offer, he's suddenly like a really attractive free agent to a lot of teams just because he can play both corner infield positions credibly, left-handed power. It's just a solid profile for a good 5-6 hitter on a good team.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have a question to ask you. All right, we kind of asked this a little bit before we came on the air. Who's going to get more money or more years this winter? Or Aroldis Chapman and or Kenley Jansen, so one of the top two closers, or Mark Trumbo? Mark Trumbo just led the sport in home runs, but that's pretty much all he does. So what's more valuable, that or a one-inning reliever?
Mark Trumbo is going to be the most divisive player on the free agent market this year. He is 18th in the Tango rankings, which will certainly annoy some people, but of course he basically brings virtually zero defensive value to the table. Maybe negative defensive value, which in a war, which incorporates...
Defense matters.
And base running matters.
We've learned that so much the last couple years.
But, you know, to bring it on the StatCast tip, Mark Trumbo was 67 barrels this year.
He led the league in barrels?
Third. Dan Cabrera and Chris with a K Davis.
That's a skill, and that is a skill.
He's a masher. But we've also... The thing is, teams, you know, a couple years ago, the Orioles kind of rejuvenated Nelson Cruz's career, and it seemed like, oh, well, he's just a product of Camden Yards, which is a great place for right-handed power hitters. But then Nelson Cruz went out and signed a four-year deal with the Mariners and has basically lived up... He's been a great deal for the Mariners.
I hated that deal, I got to be honest.
Me too.
It's worked out really well.
I had the same thoughts. So I guess I'm sort of seeing Trumbo as maybe this year's version of Nelson Cruz, and I think that some team is going to pay him to be just a DH and maybe occasional outfielder first baseman. And
he's not a bad first baseman. He just didn't get to play there in Baltimore because they had Chris Davis. He's a really poor outfielder. But if there's some team that would put him at first base, he could be an average first baseman. Is that too much to ask?
I guess. I mean, the real issue is that, you know, it's a 316 OBP this year. So for all that, I mean, that's...
For pure entertainment value, and that's all that matters, I want to see him at Coors Field. They don't have a first baseman. Put him at Coors Field. Let's see him mash some dingers. You know what's interesting? So you said he's 18th on this list. You know 16th on the list? Basically tied, because I'm not going to put too much intensive points of war projections here. His teammate, Steve Pierce. Now, I think I'm the world's biggest Steve Pierce fan. If you look at the offseason, you could find a spot for Steve Pierce on pretty much any team, right? Crushes left-handed pitching. He can play first. He can play corner outfield. He can play a little bit of second or third base. But, you know, he's hurt last year, so he didn't have a great year. He's a guy who I think you could just really find him on any single team. Couldn't you? Like, that versatility, positional versatility is so valued right now.
Yeah, for sure. He's someone that I think he's a really good fit with the Mets, who have a ton of left-handed hitting.
I've been saying that for the last three winters.
with all the left-handed hitters in the outfield and in first base, you know, there'd be plenty of at-bats for him on that team. But, you know, you could spot him against, like, looking at his pure weighted runs created plus, it's a little bit misleading, 136, because he doesn't really have to face righties all that often. But, you know, there are a lot of left-handed pitchers, and he can play a few positions, so you can sort of platoon him at a couple of spots, essentially, and find him regular bats that way.
You know who I think is going to be the best value, I think, of this offseason? Mark Melancon, right? Because, you know, Chapman's going to get paid. Kenley Jansen's going to get paid. I think those guys might touch the $100 million mark. And I know that sounds crazy, but those two guys, maybe. What are you going to get Melancon for? $40 million? Plus?
Mark Melancon, it's not sexy, but he specializes in weak contact. So while Jansen and Chapman are striking everyone out, Mark Melancon, he prevents you from hitting the ball hard. This year, 7.2% of batted balls against him were below 85 miles per hour in exit velocity, which was ninth in MLB for pitchers with 1,000 pitches.
Yeah,
he allowed five barrels all season.
All season long.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. If you look at a guy, listen, he's not as good as Zach Britton, and I'm not pretending that he is, but he does not allow the ball to be hit as hard as Zach Britton does. Part of that's because Zach Britton doesn't allow barrels. Everything gets pounded straight into the ground. But Mark Melancon's been a pretty successful and underrated closer for a bunch of teams for the last couple of years. Someone's going to get him without giving up a draft pick and pay half of what the other guy's going to get.
Yeah, lower walk rate than both Jansen and Chapman. I think he's going to be not as much as a closer can be a bargain.
Right.
But I could see him getting like half of what those guys.
That's what I'm saying. He's got San Francisco written all over him, right? That's like my number one stone cold lock of the entire winter. Mark Melancon, San Francisco Giants.
Well, that's part of why it's such a good time to be a relief pitcher on the market, because there's all these teams that we saw in the postseason when bullpens loomed large that looked really vulnerable at the back end. The Giants probably first and foremost on that list, and so it seems of all the teams that go out and sign a closer, they seem most likely. But then you have the Cubs, who are losing Chapman, so they would seemingly do so. The Dodgers, who are losing Jansen, and based on their financial might, just seem likely to be in the market for one. The Nationals are losing Melancon. They're going to want to get in that game. So there's a lot of teams out there that are contenders that usually carry fairly big payrolls that are all going to be competing for these same three guys. And to answer your question before, I think that Trumbo will, at least one of these guys will get more than Trumbo. I'm not sure if two or three of them will, but I think one of them will get more than Trumbo.
That's going to be interesting to find out. So I want to finish up asking you about some starting pitchers here, okay? There's a couple of starting pitchers on the market who are both top five in curveball spin rate, right? Rich Hill and Jeremy Hellickson. So we saw today that Hellickson did get the qualifying offer. And if you think about Jeremy Hellickson, you do not think of him as a guy who is worth $17.2 million. However, as we've talked about, the starting pitching market is hot garbage. Like, he might be the best starting pitcher, him or Rich Hill, who's the other guy I want to talk about. Bartolo Colon, who I love, but he's 44 years old.
Jason Hamill, who just had his option to
cry. Right? It's not a good market for starting pitching. So it wasn't so much shocking to me as it was to other people that Hellickson got the offer. I think he might actually turn it down. Believe that?
I could very much see it. To me, for the Phillies, it makes perfect sense to do it, because on a one-year deal, that's the thing about the qualifying offer. It's like, unless you have clear internal solutions like the Astros we talked about with Valbueno at third base, where it's like, oh, we have clear cost-controlled solutions that we think may be better, like, particularly for starting pitchers, like, one-year deal, like, it's not going to, like, loom, it's not going to hang over your franchise. Like, this won't be the Ryan Howard deal.
For, no, well, that's the thing, is they've shed so much money. You know, Howard's gone, Reese is gone, Utley's gone. They have a very young team now. They're not really paying anybody anything.
So to have a pitcher that you feel like, okay, this guy can take the ball, he can spare our bullpen a little bit to help support the young guys who may need the bullpen help a little bit more, just in terms of keeping their innings limits down. But yeah, he might turn down, but I don't really know what he'd get. I think that the trade market for starting pitchers is what's going to be fascinating.
And the other thing is, if he has to go out there with a qualifying offer on his back, he might be out there to March. Because who wants to give up a first-round pick for him?
Yeah, again, you know, what we may see is what we've seen in the past, is where it's like a team that goes out and signs Cespedes and also needs a starting pitcher might be like, well, we've already given up our first-round pick. So, like,
right, why stop now?
Yeah, why stop now? So that's sort of what we've seen, the sort of a quote-unquote strategy we've seen teams do with the qualifying offer system, which might change under the new CBA, but I imagine it won't change until at least next year, now that we're already starting this and starting the offseason and the CBA doesn't expire until December 1.
And the last guy we should bring up is StatCast hero Rich Hill. Right, Rich Hill has a top 5 curveball spin rate, a very well above average four-seam spin rate. And those are the only two pitches he throws, more or less. I think he set a record this year, 49% curveball rate. We've never seen anybody do that over more than a handful of innings. And, you know, we all know the Rich Hill story by now. He is really, really effective and unbelievably fragile, right? Like, a soft wind might blow Rich Hill over, but he's very, very good. How do you value that? I have absolutely no idea.
He doesn't have the qualifying offer attached.
He does not.
Because he was traded midseason, so that helps. I think he'll get a really nice 2-year deal.
I was thinking
2 for 36 or 2 for 40.
Oh, see, that's a little more than I thought he would get. I was going to say something like 3 for 30 or maybe 2 plus an option for 30. You think somebody will give him a guaranteed 40? I mean, that's a lot for a guy who you expect maybe 100 innings a year out of.
Or maybe it's like one of those where it's, you know, one big guaranteed year with a team option. So the team, you know, sort of like the team sort of holds the future in their hand. But he's the only player, starting pitcher on this list that you look at and feel like, okay, this guy could be a 1 or a 2 for me. And when you're the only guy that fits that bill, I think that will change the dynamics as such that will allow him to get, you know, at least, you know, potentially $40
million. I just have a feeling he's going to end up back with the Red Sox for like the 14th time, because that's where he always seems to end back up. And that's kind of where he resuscitated his career, coming out of indie ball last year with Brian Bannister, who's been a guest on the show. You know, I mean, if Dave Dombrowski is interested in that, I could totally see that happening.
I mean, they'll be a player. He's from the Boston area. He's from Milton, Massachusetts.
That's absolutely right. He's from Milton, Massachusetts. So anyway, free agency gets started. I mean, in a couple hours, we'll know what teams have handed out qualifying offers, and I believe they have 5 days after that to accept or not accept, which I don't think is enough time. But that's
entirely. I think it's a week from today.
Is it a week? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. It is a week from today. So that's I feel like that's not enough time for players to decide, because like, who even knows what the market's going to be in a week?
That's sort of the challenge. That's part of the fun.
So we'll see how the qualifying offers system changes with the new CBA. But I will say, for this upcoming winter, trades, it's going to be all about trades. It's going to be big time on trades, because you just can't go out and buy enough talent, right?
Yeah, and while we sang Andrew Simon's praises before for his piece on the 25 free agents, his piece on Theo Epstein's trade record is another worth bringing up, and something that he basically looked back at all the trades Theo Epstein has made since he took over 5 years ago in Chicago. Basically, his first trade, he lost when he traded away DJ LeMahieu and got back. That's where he got back Tyler Colvin.
No, I think Colvin went with him, and they got back Ian Stewart.
Was that right? And Casey Weathers.
Casey Weathers. All right. So LeMahieu turned into a pretty good player.
That's a trade he clearly lost.
And that was trade number one.
Since then, you can't really say he's lost a trade.
And he's won massively.
We're getting Arrieta
and Strope.
Getting Rizzo for Andrew Cashner. Getting Kyle Hendricks.
In two separate trades, getting Hendricks, Carl Edwards Jr., and Justin Grimm from Texas in two deals for Dempster and Matt Garza. I mean, both of those are steals.
You know, founder from Valbuena, not a clear win, but one they're clearly happy with.
Picking up busted starters in Wood and Cahill and turning them into useful relievers.
So the list goes on and on. And, you know, he may end up, quote-unquote, losing the Chapman trade if Gleyber Torres turns into a star, but they won the World Series. Chapman helped. It's never going to be a trade that they're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe we
flags
did that.
Fly forever. Don't forget also, he traded Jeff Samardzija for Addison Russell. That worked out okay.
Maybe that's number one trade. So anyway, point being, we've seen the Cubs basically build, you know, all the credit they're given for building a young winner. They didn't do it to the draft. Yeah, they got Bryant in the draft, but the biggest impact players on their team, for the most part, can't be a trade.
Mostly trade, one or two good draft picks in Bryant and Schwarber, a couple of big money deals for Lester and Ben Zobrist.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's all trades. And that's a good kickoff for the winter, because I think we're going to see a lot of trades.
For sure.
And I'm excited about that. So that's our show for this week. I'll be back next week. I'll see Matt in a few weeks. This is the MLB.com StatCast podcast. See you next week.